Hello, everybody. It's Ask Dutch Anything number 17. I'm James. With me is Dutch Mantel, of course, who's going to be answering your questions for the next 45 minutes or 40 minutes or so. He has two books, of course, The Tales from a Dirt Road and The World According to Dutch. For the video viewers among you, you may be wondering why a book was floating right in your face there. That was one of two books available, and the other one is, of course, The World According to Dutch. I have two books. He's got diplomas as well. You can go on the main channel, for goodness sake. We promote the heck out of him on the main episode every Friday. But for now, we're going to be doing Ask Dutch Anything. If you want to ask the Dutchman anything in a future episode every Tuesday of Ask Dutch Anything, it's questionsfordutch@gmail.com. That's the email you want to go to. Email your question there, and the best ones will make it into the script every single Tuesday. And for criminy's sake, I keep saying last week was a record. This week was a record for questions coming in. Dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens. I've filtered them through, and we're going to get to the best ones right now. And the first one, Jamie.
So how many, give me a number. How many questions actually come in?
100? A little under 100, somewhere between 70 and 80 came in.
Well, that's a lot.
In 6.5 days.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's good. Okay, keep them coming. I'll keep answering.
Good. Jamie Waldrop, Morganton, North Carolina. You all keep saying we are going to talk about Curry Man, so let's talk about Curry Man. Thank you for the show. It's a must listen, watch every week. So, Curry Man, Christopher Daniels, where did this character come from?
To my knowledge, to the best of my knowledge, I think that was Chris's idea. He kept talking about this Curry Man, or something, and all of a sudden, and it wasn't my idea, but I think it was either Vince or Jeff, we said, well, why don't you come up with the Curry Man character, and we'll put him on TV. And Curry Man, it was Chris's iteration, like that word, iteration, idea, or his version of Curry Man. And I forgot, we did some really good stuff with him. I can't remember what, we didn't have him on every week, but we would talk about him. And I don't even know what he did, because I was, usually a lot of times when this is going on, I'm in the back doing something, going over with another interview, doing a lot more stuff. And unless I watched the show, which by the time I got back home after putting 12 hours in, I wasn't in any type of condition to watch the show. So, but Curry Man, he was actually a pretty good character and pretty popular.
Did you ever sell like masks or anything?
I'm sure they did. But that, again, that was in the merchandise department. I tried to keep my duties contained to what I knew they were. And I guess you could order them online through TNA, I'm assuming you could order the t-shirts and anything that the TNA had for sale. You could order it online, which is another thing that we need to talk about, is the dividends that the talent would actually receive from the sale of their merchandise, not in TNA, but in WWE. And you know where I heard this? Now I'm just spitballing here, but Ryback. Have you followed any of Ryback stuff lately?
No.
Well, he's bitching and moaning, and rightfully so, because I think he got a gimmick check, a merchandise check, a dividend. And his dividend was for, and I think it's for 3 months. He got a check for $250-something. Now, he's been gone for 5 or 6 years, but still. When I was there, I got, and I still got it somewhere, I got a dividend check for $12. So now, let me, you know, the week that they have before WrestleMania, the week they have that you can come, and it's like, it's a meet and greet every day doing something. So you can go and you can buy stuff online or whatever and get me to sign it. But if, say, an 8x10 for me would sell for $20, and they would come and they would get me to sign it, and I would sign it. And you know what they got that 8x10, what they pay for that 8x10? About 49 cents. Because they do them in bulk. 49 cents. It's $20. And then I bet you they would have no more than, even mailing it off, they would have no more than $1.50 in it. But they got $20 for it. So that's an $18.50 profit. And you know how much I would get out of that? About less than $1. So that week before WrestleMania is nothing but money week. They're just selling merchandise and t-shirts and this and that and pictures with guys and autographs. They got to take in $1 million just doing that week leading up to WrestleMania. But when it comes time to be paid for that, you don't really get paid for that. You get paid because, say, you have a downside guarantee of, say, $200,000. That's just applied to your downside guarantee. So it's not like, and some of the big guys may be making money, you know, that are settling it hand over fist. They might be making money, but the regular guy in WWE, they don't sell enough to register that big amount at the end. So, I mean, I'm just saying that's the way it is, the way it's always been.
So Ryback is in the right then. 256 or something, did you say?
Something like that. But I have gotten, I think sometimes just to send me that costs more than what I got. But I have a check here somewhere. I'll put it up one day. It was $12 and some cents, or $14, something, not much.
Next question, Mark Dreamer. I remember the debut of a rather more robust-looking Dustin Rhodes in TNA, coinciding with probably the low point of his career, and wondered if you could talk us through working with him during this time.
In TNA?
Yes.
Well, he had a bad period. I think he had broken up with his wife at that time. And yeah, we all get depressed. And I don't know his feelings for that woman, but I'm sure he loved her. And he was just, and sometimes you see guys that put on weight, and that's because they don't give a crap. They're just sitting around eating. And he was having a hard time. So I can't hold that against him. I like Dustin a lot. So, and if he has a problem, I hate it affected his work. But the fans, they can see that, and they wonder what's going on. So what was the rest of that question?
Well, these were some of my notes. So he came into the company saying he had a split personality that he was going to embrace, and then he debuted Black Reign. So it was sort of like an anti-Gold Dust kind of thing. So instead of like a blonde wig, he had a black wig. And I remember him being quite a big boy at that time.
Well, he was trying to take the Goldust character and turn it dark, I think, or emerge from a lighthearted character like Goldust to a dark character. And sometimes that doesn't work. It's always better going from a dark character to a lighter one, because it's not as heavy and, you know, people might be able to identify with it. But then again, none of these things we do in wrestling are surefire. We don't know if they're going to work or not. That's not our job. That's not creative's job. Creative is to produce the the best example they can produce. And it's up to the fans, like the people listening in today. It's up to them whether they want to accept it or not. If they don't accept it, that's why you didn't see him around much anymore.
With that being said, it's like I know it wasn't called the hardcore division, but let's call it the hardcore division. Was he just sort of lumped in the hardcore division because no one could figure out what to do with him because he was doing barbed wire Christmas trees and 10,000 thumbtack matches and that kind of thing? And that was like totally something that you hadn't done before.
Well, I can seriously plead to this charge as Nolo Contendere. I remember him there with that dark character. I do not remember what we did with it, nor did I give a shit what we did with it, because I can look at something and tell you if I think it has a chance. I can't tell you if it's going to go or not.
Just going back to Black Rain, he just stopped turning up in 2008 and then he was fired. Do you remember this at all?
Yeah, I think he just quit coming. I think he stopped just honoring his bookings. And we said, well, and it's not that we fired him. I think he just fired himself. Yeah, he just, you know, you can't go to work unless you come. So,
right. Next question. Rick Graham. Hello, Dutch. I have a question. If I could get your take, how did deregulating wrestling hurt or help the business?
Well, deregulating wrestling was because of the taxes that some state athletic commissions charged, and they didn't do anything. The state athletic commissions didn't. They were just a tax collector under a different name is all they were. I was in New Jersey once and they showed up, and it's just like two or three guys that show up and they're having a good time. They get to go to wrestling and sit around and talk to the wrestlers, and they can watch the show if they want to or not. And then they take your blood pressure and that's actually just to show that they do something. They take your blood pressure and something else. I remember
check
one time
prostate.
I was do what now?
Check the prostate. They didn't bother.
Only you would come up with something like that. No, they did not jab my prostate. I don't think so. But one time I showed up. And they wanted to put those little things they stick on you, you know, to take your, mm-hmm. And they put them all on me. Now, listen, everybody that knows me know that I'm a pretty hairy guy. So they would put them on, but they wouldn't work because they didn't get to, they had too much hair. And they said, well, we're going to have to shave you. I said, like shit. I said, I'm not going to go out there and look like Connect the Dot. I'm not going to do that because you're going to shave it here and shave it there. And then when you pull this off, I'm going to have like little bitty shaved little circles around my front and my back. I said, it's going to look like crap. And I forgot. And they said, well, we can't do it and you can't work. I said, no, I'm going to work. And I got in a big argument with them and they said, okay, just say he worked and let him go. That's so I get the payday. If they'd have put it down that I couldn't pass that deal because they couldn't get a check on me, you know, then they'd ask me and it'd be more trouble than what it was worth. So, but they let me go ahead and work without it, which I'm glad, but all they did was collect taxes. Like they would take, like in New Jersey, I forgot what they took. Say you made $500 in a town or whatever. Well, they take like, I forgot what it was. I think they take like 5% of that, which is like 20, 25 bucks, which doesn't sound like a lot, but you know, 20, 25 bucks, you know, when they add that up with 30 guys on the card or whatever, that's quite a big pay. That's quite a good payday. They can just go over there and pick it up and they're paid right then. And they did nothing. They had no health insurance. If you got hurt, you're on your own. Or the company has to pick it up. They didn't pay your health insurance. They didn't pay nothing. You just paid taxes to them, and that's all they got. That's why Vince, and I don't blame Vince. Vince fought them and won because they didn't do anything.
Let me give you the quote. In fact, this is from independent.co.uk, a write-up. February 10th, 1989 was the day the facade died, as in front of the state of New Jersey Senate on a bill to remove wrestling from the regulations that had been applied by the athletic commissions. Vince McMahon, representing the World Wrestling Federation, stated that professional wrestling should be defined as an activity in which the participants struggle hand in hand primarily for the purpose of providing entertainment to spectators rather than conducting a bona fide athletic contest. With these words, everybody's suspicions had been confirmed. Wrestling was not, in fact, a legitimate sporting contest. As a result, the bill deregulated professional wrestling, passed by a vote of 37-1. In 1989, I don't know if you're in Continental or USWA or wherever it was, but what was the reaction on the lower leagues to Vince McMahon's admission in public like this?
Well, it was like, who wrote that note to us? That who was the guy that sent the question in?
Oh, Rick Graham.
Rick, it hurt initially a little bit, but it's like saying, well, it's going to rain one day this week. You know, everybody knew it anyway. Now it was confirmed. It didn't really have that big of an effect. And now, even though we know all this stuff today, wrestling is as popular today, or more popular now, than it was then. See, there we were trying to work the facade that, oh, yeah, we're in there trying to kill each other. But it's actually now that they know that it's for their entertainment, I think it's better. And I don't know if it hurt that much then, because the business was in 1989, it was fading anyway.
Yeah, I think it was only only the WWF that was still thriving. All the independents, all the territories were either gone or going.
Wasn't WWC still there? WCW, I mean?
Yeah, but WCW and 89 were falling off as well by this point. It was only WWF that were thriving. Everyone else was suffering.
And the business was, you know, it was in the tank already, so we didn't really... It couldn't do much harm than what we've already done to it ourselves. So Vince at least straightened that out. I'll say that for him, because it wasn't even his money. They were taking, the money was coming from the talent anyway. Like if they take, say, $25 off 500, you get 475, which ain't a bad payday for going out there for 10 minutes. But it was already in the tank anyway. It didn't do that much harm.
Now, this question sort of leads on to this. So, Ursin de Roche. Dear Dutch, I really enjoy listening to you tell stories from the past, but when pro wrestling had a particular place in an American culture. But now, with the advent of the internet and social media and the proliferation of insider dirt sheets and websites giving away results, and even future creative plans on YouTube channels like this one, breaking down the moves and showing you how it's done, should wrestling even exist in the 21st century? I know these people are making lots of money still, but from an enjoyment standpoint, it seems that wrestling was not meant for this day and age. Most of the time, it is not entertaining, and I find myself mostly watching old footage like a number of longtime fans. Best to you and yours.
What's his name?
Oh, God. I've just switched the page around now. Ursin de Roche.
Ursin. I have never met anybody named Ursin. I read this question before, and I said, have I ever known anybody by the name of Ursin? No. Well, Ursin, let me tell you, does it need to exist in this day and age? All it follows is the marketplace. If it shouldn't exist, there wouldn't be a market for it. Therefore, they wouldn't be big cards in Madison Square Garden. They wouldn't be big cards in pay-per-views, in baseball stadiums and football stadiums around the country. If it's not supposed to be, guess what? It won't be, because, like I just said, we are the people that put wrestling together. We don't dictate whether it goes or not. The fans do. So if the fans want to see it, they will come and see it. I think it's perfectly normal to have a pro wrestling footprint in the country. It's one of the oldest sports. It is the oldest sport known to man, wrestling. Mm-hmm. But if it's not supposed to, it won't be there. It's like football. If you have a football game in a 50,000 seat stadium and 5,000 show up, guess what? It's not going. People just don't want it. So, and that's what we were talking about, just the question previous to this one, that, you know, we don't set the parameters for it. The fans do. So, yes, I do believe. And if you're watching older stuff, more power to you. I mean, watch what you like, because nobody is dictating to anybody what they can watch. And look at YouTube, all the old wrestling stuff on there. If YouTube didn't have a market for it, they wouldn't have it. So this business is continuously reinventing itself. Sometimes it's good. Sometimes it's not so good. Sometimes it's great. But sometimes we're always reinventing everything we do.
There's always going to be a market for it. Now, next question. David from Omaha, Nebraska says, "Hey, Dutch, do you have a story of Jim Cornette's worst meltdown in Smoky Mountain Wrestling? For whatever reason, wrestlers not showing up, something was wrong with the venue, anything. I would just assume to keep that promotion afloat must have been very stressful on him."
Oh, man. Stressful on him. It was stressful on me. We would go up. I lived in Nashville for years and years and years. I would go up from Nashville to Knoxville or that way. And then he would have some, I swear to God, some mountain inlet up there in those hills that they had to pipe sunlight to. It was so far back in those hills, you would go this way and then you would go that way. And then sometimes those curves were so deep, you would meet yourself going around the next turn. It was going up a mountain and it was like, you can only go like 20, 30 miles an hour. And it was way back in those hills. I don't even know how the TV signal got back in there. But I remember one day we went up there and hell, you'd have to leave like 6 o'clock in the morning. Well, you didn't leave that early, but they were long, long trips. So we got up there one day and Jim always looked like in a perpetual state of killing himself. He was stressed out and you could see him sweating. And one day I walked backstage, which is, was in a high school gym. I walked out in the hallway and down a little, you know, corridor. Jim had the guy that pulls the cables for the camera. He had him by the throat and had him jacked up on a wall and saying, "I'll kill you, you SOB." And I went, Jimmy, please calm down. And the guy was scared too, because, you know, Jimmy is not that big, but he is, he looks like he means what he says. So if somebody grabbed me and said, "I'm going to kill you," I'm going to have to take him at his word. I mean, that's getting pretty serious. And I don't know what it was about, but all he did was pull the cord. So whatever he did, I apparently had something to do with cord pulling, I would assume, but still not in the realm of what Jimmy would attempt to kill him for. I mean, you pull a cord from here to the cameraman stops, then you stop pulling. But he was upset. And, you know, to be truthful, he was probably upset about a lot of other stuff. And it just came to a head when he got, when he got to that guy pulling the cord.
Did he ever get upset with you?
He didn't kill him. Say what now?
Did he ever get upset with you?
No, never. Because Jimmy, I was the first guy he managed. Jimmy. I knew Jimmy. I knew his mother. You know, when he would come to Louisville, Kentucky, the convention center, I think that was the name of it, and he would go in the back and he would take pictures. He became the go-to photographer for guys getting their pictures made that we would take from him, and we would sell at the gimmick tables. because we could sell our gimmicks, which was actually sometimes our gimmicks, our pictures actually added up to more than what we were making wrestling. So he respected me and he wanted to get into business, and Jerry Jarrett finally gave him a job of managing. And I didn't know this at the time, but Jimmy was a huge, huge fan, not only of Memphis wrestling, but of all wrestling. So, and he was a friend, and I'd known him a long time. Jerry Jarrett finally gave him a job, and he managed me first as a guy. I forgot who he managed first as a woman. She's passed away now.
Sherry Martel.
Sherry Martel. But in retrospect, I never treated Jimmy badly. I never hollered at him. I never screamed at him. I never treated him like he was like what we call a mark. I was always very nice to him, because I always treated people the way they treated me. Jimmy and his mother always treated me well. And so I just, in retrospect, I just did the same to him. So, and he may have gotten a little upset with me at times because I did commentary, but I don't think so. And I don't think to the point that he would come to me and yell and scream at me. I don't think he would do that. If something bothered him, he would come to me and talk to me about it, and then we would straighten it out. I mean, he owned the company, him and the guy that, whatever his name was, they owned the company. So he was basically my boss, but no, he never screamed at me, never got upset with me.
Next question, Anthony from Mount Washington, Kentucky. I live outside Louisville and I go to OVW from time to time. This last Thursday, Paul White, aka Big Show, came out. He announced fans in attendance and watched at home, would have a QR code to scan for buy one, get one free tickets for the upcoming AEW show on November 1st. This show will be at the Yum Center in Louisville. In fact, we were looking at a video, Jarrett, and he mentioned you in a promotional video. I guess my question would be, is this because AEW cannot sell out the Yum Center like WWE always does? Does AEW have to give tickets away to draw a crowd? Are their tapings not drawing? When Raw or SmackDown come here, they always sell out. Again, love the podcast. So I think it's AEW and their issues selling tickets at this point.
Well, you're talking about WWE and SmackDown. They always sell out. Raw and SmackDown always sell out. Well, the crowd is always full. The seats are always full. But yet, if they're short on seats, they will what they call paper the town. And they get actually pretty good seats, because it's in WWE's favor and SmackDown's favor to show a full house every time it appears on TV. Now, I have been on some WWE cards and SmackDown cards where it wasn't full, and they papered the town also, papered the area, it means give tickets away, and it still wasn't full. But that's where they just arrange their camera angles, and they shoot across to where in what they call the hard camera section, that's where it's all filled in. You don't see this on TV, especially when they go back and edit it. It looks full. Could AEW sell out the Yum Center? How big is a Yum Center? 20,000?
Oh, Lord, yeah.
It took Freedom Hall's place. I know that.
Well, just while you're saying that, hang on, Yum Center Wiki. I mean, it'll be far more, because it's got to be set up for wrestling, hasn't it? So for basketball and volleyball, it says, somewhere around 21,000, 22,000.
Yeah.
End stage, 17,500. So yeah, it's a big old place.
Yeah. No, they could not. I don't think they could sell out Louisville. I really don't.
But it is a misnomer that people think, well, AEW is struggling to sell tickets at the moment, and they're making fun of the buy one, get one free deals and papering this up. But WWE still do this.
They do that. They just don't do it in not a lot of people heard that, even when Big Show did it. He just did it to the crowd, didn't he?
Yeah, for OVW apparently.
Okay, well, power to them. I'm glad they're out there where they can do this. So it's giving work to all the wrestlers who need it. And the wrestling fans, it gives them another place to go and another thing to excite their interest, because if they're interested in professional wrestling, AEW does, they don't do a bad job. They do a pretty good job on some of that stuff. I'm not saying it's perfect, but WWE hasn't always been perfect. None of us have been perfect. But I don't think that AEW on their own selling tickets can fill up the Yum Center.
No.
Yum. You imagine the name Yum.
That was a horrible name.
It horrible. It ain't that good. Yum Center. Hey, where's the Yum Center? I don't know.
Are they like the parent company of KFC or something like that?
I think so.
Just because it's bouncing off that and just mentioning AEW, you've probably seen the photos of some of the half-empty arenas that AEW are running at the moment, which obviously isn't the greatest look. And they do cover it up pretty well on TV, you know, where they only fill in basically two sides and, you know, the ringside all around. But should AEW in the future be running smaller venues, or would that be detrimental to their presentation?
Hey, James, I'm going to tell you, and I'm going to tell you one more time, stop making sense. I mean, I told, you know, we were talking about TNA earlier in our other podcast. We'd go to buildings and like 30% of it would be have people. I said, guys, I got an idea. What? Why don't we run smaller building venues to where we can kind of pack it out, you know? Because that always looks better on TV than seeing vast swatches of this arena just completely empty. That almost defeats the purpose of what you're trying to produce. So run smaller venues. But they wanted to run the big ones. They wanted to be, at one point, they wanted to run the same buildings as WWE. Well, what that meant was you just lose more money. These buildings are not cheap. Because when you start thinking you're gonna book a 15,000 seat arena and advertise that and bring all your people in, and it's very, very expensive. I bet sometimes they have booked some venues and the venue house, the live gate, may have been enough just to pay the rent, not even to pay the talent. So you're going into a hole. But my suggestion to them would be, until they hit a hot run, but see, and that's difficult to tell too, because they have to book these buildings 6 months or more in advance.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't know what you're doing in six months.
Exactly. You could almost be like running on like false optimism, saying we're going to turn this around in 6 months. We need to keep on booking these massive arenas because you never know when we're going to turn the tide. But then also, what if you start booking 2,000 and 3,000 capacity smaller places, and then it looks like a second tier promotion because of it? So, I mean, there's sort of that angle as well. You don't want to look like you basically ECW, essentially.
Well, you're saying that on TV, if you see 2,000 or 3,000 people in a big building, is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying if there's 2,000 or 3,000 people packing in a smaller event, let's say they sell it out. I mean, it's still a sellout, and it's cheaper to run. But then you're supposed to be looking like a national, international wrestling powerhouse, and you're running mid-sized venues.
Well, you just don't say anything about it. I mean, only the local people are going to know that anyway. But to a nationwide audience, why are you selling it out? It's easier to talk about a sellout than, we got a good turnout today. But if it's packed out, it's packed out, and the people are more lively. It's more easy to work. The talent feels better. The people feel better. And I think try that for a while. And if your houses come up and it looks like it's going to last a while, and I don't know who makes that decision, I guess the boss, but then you go to bigger buildings. But to take a brand new, and AEW is not brand new, of course, but to take a brand new or a new promotion to a 15 or 16,000 seater, you're not going to fill it up. Because WWE has trouble filling that stuff up, putting every star they got on it. So that's just my suggestion. They can do what they want to do, but that was what I would do.
One or two more. I promise we'll stick it to one or two more. Gianni, hi guys. You just posted on YouTube a Mount Rushmore question for top guys in the industry. My question is, what would your top/Mount Rushmore of biggest heat/fans irate moments in wrestling history would be? So what angles would you say really, really, in a good way, or maybe even white heat, bad way, really upset the fans?
Well, I'm trying to think in WWE terms. I don't remember anything really that upset them that badly.
It can be anywhere. I mean, you've seen enough riots before.
One that I can remember, and I was there, was in the Omni. It was a Sunday. I think it started at 7 o'clock. It's at the end of the night. Dusty had trouble with the Anderson brothers for like months and months and months. Dusty didn't have a partner. And it went on to where the Assassins, they beat him up on TV one day, and Ole came out there, I think, and saved Dusty, which everybody says, why would he do that? And he says, Dusty, I tell you what, I hate your guts. But he said, if you're looking for a partner, but they got Dusty in the cage in the Omni, and it was full, like 16,000 people. So they beat the hell out of Ole to Dusty. Dusty made the tag to Ole, and the people popped, and he got in there. And then Dusty was just slumped over in the corner. And then all of a sudden, Ole just stopped and said, all right, you son of a bitch, this is what you get. And all three of them started beating the living crap out of Dusty. So I told them it was a setup the whole time. And they beat him and beat him, and they were pulling people off the cage. The people were upset. Finally told them they had to get out. And they left Ole laying. They had the damn biggest riot. It took them almost 5 minutes to get the Andersons back from the ring, just to get them back to the dressing room. They were fighting them the whole way. So that was when people are really touched by something. Dusty, and they were mad at themselves, really, because even Ole had sold them on the idea that he needed to get even with his brothers more than he needed to get even with Dusty. But Ole explained this. He said, Dusty, I don't like you. You don't like me, but I need you and you need me. And boy, Dusty didn't want to do it. And finally, Ole convinced him that, yeah, you're the one I need. And they started that match, and Dusty started, and Dusty sailed along for a while, and he's doing good on his own and blah, blah, blah. And he lulled him in that false sense of security. So when Dusty was about ready to make that tag, make it, he made the tag. Now they're going to see, and Dusty and Ole come in there like, come on. And everybody just stopped. And everybody went, what the hell? Then they all turned, and Ole pointed his finger like, okay, this is payback, bitch. And they started whooping his ass. And now they knew the setup was in. Didn't need to tell them nothing. And Ole's interviews after that, he said, I had to keep from throwing up when I was talking to you and telling you about my brother, blah, blah, blah. And they just beat the shit out of him. And it got over like a bastard. It's hard to believe. Sometimes they took their time on it, and that was the hottest thing they had, and they worked around that till they got it right where they wanted it. And then they decided to do the turn, which was one of the best I've ever seen. So, and I'm standing in the back. Usually wrestlers go out there and help the other wrestlers. I said, nah, they got enough police out there. I think I'll just keep my ass back here. And they were throwing stuff. Oh my God. It was a full-scale riot, really. I think they arrested like 15 people, 10 or 15 people, took them off to jail. And then when they got in the back, you know, everything was fine, except maybe, and some people waited on them to leave. They had to run them out of the parking lot. So that was one of the hottest things that I've ever seen. And I've seen things like that hot like that in Puerto Rico, not necessarily because people got mad, just people got drunk and they just wanted to beat the hell out of Abdullah one night. So I remember one night Abdullah, they was mad at Abdullah all the time anyway. So he come out of the ring. We was in a baseball stadium. The people came out of the stands and out of the, like they had ringside. They usually don't have ringside. And they circled the infield, like from first base to second base to third base on the sand part. And they were throwing stuff at Abdullah. I thought they were tearing him up. And Abdullah was keeping his opponent as close as he could to him to keep from getting hit. Or maybe some of it would hit his opponent, not him. And I remember after my match, they were so hot that I had started drinking. And I drank about, I don't know, not a six pack, but quite a few. There was a broken 2x4 in the dugout. And I pick up the 2x4. And this is a Southern term, I slung it out of the dugout and went whoop, whoop, going around. And it hit some guy right here in the head. And as soon as I hit, I saw the blood. I went nuts. I said, oh, my God, I've killed that guy. And then I ran. I was a chicken shit. I just ran away. And somebody, they actually come in and say, who threw that out of the dugout? I said, I don't know. I didn't see it. So. But anyway, it knocked him silly. And I bet the last time he would participate in like a mini riot. And I didn't mean to hit. I meant to throw it at somebody's leg, but I didn't. I hit him. And if you're listening today, Juan or Carlos or Rafael, lo siento. That means I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Lo siento por mi error, my mistake. So I've apologized. I almost got in a fight with Lars one time in Florida.
Go on.
Well, Lars, see, they like a lot of amateur wrestling in Florida. So I'm booked against Lars one day at TV. I was only been to business 3 years, 4 years. And my match with Lars was getting closer. And I kept noticing people coming in the TV room. And it was getting crowded because we would watch all those matches. So I went, I wonder why all these people are crowding in here all of a sudden. Well, my match was up next. So while I was mulling that strategic question that I asked myself, but with no answer, I went to the ring. And Lars was always the part. He'd take you down. He'd ride you. And I have no amateur experience at all. So he took me down and rode me a little bit. It's okay. And then he took me down and then he got on top of me, but he shot his wrist down beside my eyeball and was really, really going back. And it was kind of starting to irritate me, started to hurt. I went, hey, Lars, hey, man, lighten up. He didn't say nothing. I said, lighten up, man. He said, yeah, you little bitch. He said something, you son of a bitch, something. And I knew one thing in wrestling that I think the Briscoes taught me. It's called the Gamby roll, where you just roll ahead. I mean, they got the defense for you going backwards, but I rolled ahead and I grabbed his foot and took him down and I embarrassed him. It was actually, I shot for it and I took him down. And I got on top of him. I said, grab your finish now or you're not fucking getting it. So he hooked his finish. I give up. I rolled out, went to the back. And then Lars come in all mad and pissed off. And all the other guys, they said, well, damn. That didn't come out like we thought it would come out. Actually, it gave me respect in the dressing room. And I went in there and I told him, I said, Lawrence, you ever do that again? I said, I'm going to beat the, I couldn't beat a damn banana. I said, I'm going to beat the, I was good talking. I'm going to beat the shit out of you. And he said, yeah, man, he's about brain damaged anyway. And I always remember this, Jerry Briscoe came in and he was the assistant booker. He came in and he cussed Lawrence out. He said, Lawrence, I don't know what you're trying to do, but he said, why are you treating Dutch like this? Dutch is here to do a job. He's here to put you over. He's not here to get hurt. And he said, now, if you want to damn shoot with somebody, he said, we can wait this TV's over and we can go out there and get in the ring. And he shut up. And I never, and the last time I saw Jerry, I thanked him for that. I don't even think he even remembers doing it. But I thanked him for taking up for me. Because he was just an asshole.
I haven't, do you know, it was only when you mentioned Jerry that I remembered. Yeah, we probably told that story, or you told that story probably like when we first started doing this podcast. So mm-hmm. I'm glad that's been brought back out because it's a great story. We'll ask one more, then we'll close out. Philip Fisher, hey, Dutch really loved the show. It's the only wrestling podcast I listen to. I love Memphis wrestling and always wondered, you, Bill Dundee, and Jerry Lawler always had the hardest looking working punches I ever saw, especially Lawler. Did you ever need to tell either one of them to ease up a bit? Because it always looked like they were ringing some bells when they went through it.
Well, Lawler, you didn't have to worry about. Dundee, he would get a little bit erratic with some of those punches. Yeah, you know, one time he knocked the shit out of me. And, you know, when you, and he knows he hit me hard. I know he hit me hard. So what is the purpose of hitting him hard back? Now he's suffering too. So I just kind of cussed at him a little bit. He got out of the ring and he was kind of laughing it off. And give me a second or two, I'll calm down. He didn't mean to really hit me, I don't think. So, but yeah, he would get a little bit stiff with some of those punches sometimes. So, and sometimes you'd have to come back for something. I would never come back with a punch or something, or I would maybe just tell him or lock up hard with him and say, and I always had a saying like, hey, do I owe you money or something or what? I'll pay you. Stop. And they usually stop. Yeah, but sometimes those punches they would get in there, because if you throw in really realistic looking punches, something's going to slip through. But Lawler never hit me hard. Ever.
Of all the people you wrestled and actually experienced this with, who had the stiffest working punch then? You know, not someone who like was trying to do it on purpose, who just laid it in.
I remember I told you about that Brockus guy, didn't I?
Oh, yes.
Oh, God. I was thinking about leaving the ring. That's bull crap. And the thing about those bodybuilders, and I've said this before, they blow up. And blow up, I mean, they run out of oxygen. And they go, don't ever stand there while one of them hits you then, because he has no control. He has a lack of oxygen to the brain, and he doesn't know what wrestling is. See, wrestling is, wrestlers work under the same motto as doctors. Do no harm. But I think a lot of wrestlers didn't really live by that oath, because they would just knock the hell out of you. But those are only the ones that couldn't work. Most of them, the punches looked like shit and didn't hurt, but they looked bad. So, but I threw a pretty good working punch. And Dundee did too, and Lawler did it, which is actually very rare in a territory that you find three guys with, you know, realistic looking punches. So, but they were there. I thought we threw good ones too, better than any other territory I knew.
Of the established stars or veterans, are we saying Bill Dundee then?
That was a little careless.
Maybe not even careless, but just laid it in all the time.
No, he laid it in all the time. He just, no, nobody's going to lay it in all the time. They're going to get a receipt somewhere along the line. You know, if a guy lays it in and he knows he lays it in, his next words are, I'm sorry. That's all he has to say is, "I'm sorry," which meant that one got away from me. It's like, I'm going to use a baseball pitcher again. If he does a brushback, sometimes they do it on purpose, but sometimes when they come in close and hit you, they meant to hit you. Batters know that. So if a guy hits you like that, so, but anyway, he didn't throw them all the time, but some would get away from him.
We will end it there then. For next week and every...
I'm ready for more questions.
I'm ready for my dinner. I'm hungry.
Oh, so you're saying that your dinner means more to you than our fans do for answering these questions.
Absolutely. Unequivocally, okay. I would say that. No, well, I think we've reached our time. We've given the fans more than enough to be coping with for the next week. Always leaving wanting more, as they say.
Yeah, I actually enjoy the fan questions.
I know you do. You say that quite a lot as well. Yeah, you enjoy the fan questions most. We should, to be honest, as you know, I told you before, I've got well over 100 pages worth of fan questions we've not got to. So at some point, we'll go through the archives and get some of the best ones out of there as well.
Okay, man. All right. Appreciate it. Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. So for everybody, thank you very much for watching every Tuesday and Friday, of course. Questions for Dutch if you want your question considered for a future episode. But for now, Dutch, we the people.
We the people.